Valentine believed any speech she might make would be Scrimshaw in a casket. What would happen to him would happen regardless. The only words that would count would be those that would place him in prison or send him to the garage. The hours slipped away until sundown, and the prison slowly bled off the heat it had soaked in during the day. Valentine lay in his cot, arms and legs thrown wide to allow the perspiration to disperse.
Room search.
Valentine knew the routine. They took him to a holding cell, this one had real bars, while two guards searched his room. The process usually took a half hour or so. This time, it took an hour. Were they worried he constructed some kind of weapon to use in court? When they returned him to his cell, Valentine noticed the usual cart outside, piled with his linens. Young looked at the other guard.
I'll take it from here, Steve-O.
You sure?
I'm sure. Enjoy your dinner.
Good luck, Major Valentine.
You mean good luck tomorrow, don't you?
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Steve-O stuck out his hand, and Valentine shook it.
Just wanted to say I done it.
Steve-O wandered down the hall, whistling. Maybe he'd picked the tune up from Roderick.
You've got a letter. It says that it's not to be delivered to you until after your trial, but we had to check it anyway. No reason we couldn't check it before.
Of course.
Here you go. I get the feeling it's not from a friend.
Valentine saw the same plain envelope and paper. He opened the trifolded message. Enjoy the hanging. Wish I could be there.
Kind of funny this person being so sure of your verdict.
Funny is right.
Young extracted a multi-tool pocket knife, unfolded a screwdriver, and cleaned a black mark from beneath his thumb. A red-painted key dangled from the ring on the knife. Valentine saw it glitter in the dim light coming in from his window.
I've never had a problem with my job before, Major. Most people wind up here, well, they deserve it. The ones that don't get spat back out, usually along with some who do. Better that way than the other. But in 16 years, I've never seen anything like this.
Young pointed to a laundry bag on Valentine's bed.
Fresh linens for your bed and a new smock. Girl in the laundry is new. I think she doesn't read so good. If they screwed up, I'll be back in an hour and 15 minutes and I'll get you a new set of clothes.
Young placed the knife in his pocket.
Well, I gotta get down to the yard. We got sick dogs tonight, and until the vet is done looking at them, it's the two-legged animals that gotta walk between the wire. I know the night before a trial is always slow. Hope you get some sleep. Eventually.
As Young turned, Valentine heard the pocket knife bounce off his boot and hit the floor. It slid under his cot.
Damn cheap service trousers. Cotton my ass. More like knitted lint.
Young slammed the door behind himself, slammed it so hard it didn't close properly. Valentine didn't hear the deadbolt shoot home. Valentine waited one amazed second, then put his slip-on shoe in between the door and the jamb so it wouldn't close accidentally. He checked his laundry bag. A complete guard uniform, right down to polished shoes and belt, hat and handkerchief, was inside. Valentine read the stitched-on name tag. Young.
Thank you, Corporal Young.
He got into the uniform. It was a bit roomy, but he didn't look ridiculous once he punched a new hole in the belt with the knife's awl. It was a handy little tool. Two kinds of screwdriver, two blades, a saw and fish scaler, a can opener, a file, an awl, and a clipper. Though the last didn't look up to the job of cutting the wire in the yard. He put wadded up papers, one of them was the mystery note, around his feet so they fit better in the size 12 shoes. It occurred to him that if he were to pass as Young at a cursory glance, he'd need to be heavier. He wound a sheet around his midsection and put the belt back on at its worn notch. Feeling hot with excitement, Valentine stepped into the hall, trying to walk with his head turned down and handkerchief wiping his nose. He'd never seen cameras in the hall of this part of the prison, but he wanted to be safe. He left the room behind with no regret. When was the last time he slept in the same spot so many days in a row? His cabin in the Thunderbolt, most likely. He walked down the hall in the direction of the edge of the asterisk. Then he stopped in front of a door two down from his. Roderick's. The man was guilty of an atrocious crime. But if the system was gamed? Valentine looked through the window. The cot was empty. Had Young arranged for two escapes? Then his eyes picked up a figure in the gloom behind the sink-cum-toilet. Roderick had cheated the hangman. What looked like a twisted-up sheet was knotted around the sink tap. Roderick was in a sitting position, but off the floor and held up by his sheet, face purple and tongue sticking out as stiffly as his legs. Valentine turned away from the window and looked at the dim hallway light to get the image out of his retinas. Every other time they'd brought him through the center of the asterisk, but there was a fire exit sign above a heavy door. While he knew some of the routes through the center of the building, there was too much chance of meeting another guard. Valentine tried the red key on the heavy lock, Roderick's purple tongue filling his vision every time he didn't concentrate, and the fire escape door opened. For a young guard, Young thought things through well enough. He listened with hard ears and heard footsteps somewhere on the floor below. Valentine slipped off the guard's shoes, wincing at the sound of paper crinkling. The tiniest sounds were magnified when one was trying to keep silent, and padded down the stairs to the bottom level. He searched the doorframe leading outside. The door to the exterior had an alarm on it. Valentine flipped up a plastic access cover and saw a keypad with a green-faced digital readout. Someone had written 1144 on the interior. Valentine passed a wetted thumb over the ink, and it smeared easily. It was still fresh. He punched the numbers into the keypad and then hit a key at the bottom marked Enter. Nothing changed color. Every nerve on edge, Valentine pushed open the crash door.
Thank God for minimum security.
A real prison would have had at least two more layers of doors. He put the shined shoes back on. While rugged enough for streetwear, he wondered how long they'd last if he had to hike out. His good boots were in storage somewhere in the bowels of the prison complex. The night air felt cool and clean, but the best thing about it was the amount. Free sky stretched overhead as far as even the cat's eyes could see. Valentine drank in the Arkansas night like a shot of whiskey, and even the memory of Roderick's tongue faded a little. Keeping to the shadows, he walked around the edge of the building. Every now and then he stopped and pulled on a window as though checking to see if it was locked, all the while making for the pathway from the center of the asterisk to the gate in the double wire. A few lights burned in the subsidiary buildings and the courthouse. Valentine stepped onto the path leading to the gate and strode toward the gate. He sneezed repeatedly into his handkerchief as he stepped into the flood of light around the twin vehicular gates. Valentine had seen the gatehouse in operation often enough. People were supposed to travel through the inside, but guards desiring access to the area between the double row of fencing usually just had them open the gates. Cap pulled low on his head, he looked into the window, then stopped. Alessa Duvalier sat on some kind of console, legs prettily crossed, though she was in what Valentine thought of as her traveling clothes. A long jacket was folded carelessly next to her, her walking stick, which concealed a sword, next to it.
And so the blonde gives birth and asks the doctor, "How can I be sure it's mine?"
Shit. How did someone as ugly as Young end up with you?
Oh, kindness. He's a very kind man.
Oh, if you ever want to trade him in on a newer model.
The young guard waved casually at Valentine, not taking his eyes off Duvalier. She hit something without waiting for permission, and the twin gates slid sideways on greasy tracks. Valentine nipped out of sight of the gate and walked quickly down the road. In just a few minutes, Duvalier pulled him off the road and gave him a brief embrace.
I can never leave you alone, can I?
My luck always turns whenever you're not around.
If they arrested everyone who ever quietly shot a Quisling.
Let's not mention arrests or prisons for a while, all right? As of this moment, I'm a fugitive from justice, subject to the escape law.
It's not so bad. My whole life, I've been a fugitive from just about everything.
What's the plan?
That's your end. But I got a start underway. Oh, that Corporal Young's a good man. We need to burn those clothes.
You've got replacements?
They're with Anka.
Duvalier turned Valentine into the woods, and an owl objected somewhere. Valentine heard the soft flap of bats above, hunting insects in the airspace between branches and the ground. They stopped to listen twice, then found a burned-out house. A transport truck with a camouflaged canvas-covered back sat in front of it. Valentine marveled at it. The ruins of the garage held a small charcoal fire and a very large, fawn-colored grog.
My David, we have escaped again.
If we're still at liberty in 24 hours, I'll call it an escape. Where'd you get the truck?
Stiakowski requisitioned us a transport.
Valentine stripped out of his uniform, and Duvalier flitted about gathering up the guard's clothing. Anka handed him a too familiar dun-colored overall.
Labor regiment?
It goes with the truck. The big boy looks like he could do a hard day's work with a shovel.
And you?
Duvalier covered her fiery red hair with a fatigue cap, climbed into her own overall, and zipped it up over freckled shoulders.
I'm management. You two look like the all-day lunch break type. Besides Val, you're the suckiest kind of driver.
Where do we go? My people will gladly shelter us at Omaha.
We'd have to cross half of Southern Command. No, let's go east.
East? Nothing there but river and then the Kurians, until the Piedmont.
I have an old friend in the Yazoo Delta, and I've got a mind to visit Memphis.
Memphis? The music's to die for, but the Kurians see to it that you do the dying.
Duvalier sprinkled something that smelled like kerosene out of a bottle onto the clothes and tossed them on the charcoal. They began to burn with admirable vigor.
Allie, I got my claws into a job. I'm wondering more and more about Post's wife, Gail.
She's gotta be dead if she was shipped.
No. She was some kind of priority cargo. I'll explain later. We need to go to the area around Arkansas Post on the river. Can you manage that?
Says the guy who just broke out of a high-security lockup thanks to me?
Medium security.
Duvalier tossed her bundle of traveling clothes and sword stick into the back of the truck.
How do I look?
You're better suited singing in the dome than for the labor regiment.
Gratitude. The man's got a vocabulary like a dictionary and he doesn't even know the meaning of the word.
Please, we had best be going.
The truck bumped eastward along the torn-up roads. A substantial piece of Consul Solon's army had been borrowed from the area around Cairo, Illinois, and points east, and they had employed a spike-like mechanism called a pave plow to destroy the roadbeds as they went home. Patching was still being done, so most vehicles found it easier to drive on the gravel shoulder. Duvalier drove, Ankar rode shotgun, with his formidable gun pointing out through the liftable front windscreen to rest on the hood, and Valentine bounced along in the back, feeling every divot the worn-out shock absorber struck and hanging onto the paint and rust frame for safety. About noon, he felt the truck lurch to a stop. Duvalier spoke through the flap separating the driver from the cargo bed.
Just a road check. Rounders.
Afternoon, Digger. Transport warrant and vehicle check. Jesus, that's some big grog. He trained?
He's a citizen. Sick relief to Humboldt Crossing. There's the medical warrant. We've got an unidentified fever in the back, so you want to keep clear.
Do we? Well, we'll have to risk it. Orders to check every vehicle. We had a breakout at the military prison in Mountain Home.
Someone important, I take it.
David Valentine. Part Indian, black hair, scar on right side of face.
Never heard of him. He run over a general's dog?
Killed some Quisling prisoners, they say.
He used too many bullets?
Whoa, Sarge, we got someone back here.
Light poured into the back of the truck, hurting Valentine's eyes and giving him an instant headache. The hole was only big enough to put his head through.
Well, well, well.
He doesn't look too sick. Wouldn't you say, Slick?
No.
This look like our Quisling killer to you?
No, Sarge. 5'1 in Chinese, 3 gold teeth. No way this is our man.
I should get my eyes checked.
The sergeant wrote something down.
I need to erase, because I see a 6'6 black individual with a big tattoo of Jesus on his chest. Oh, crap, this stop form looks like shit now.
He tore a piece of printed paper off his pad, wadded it in one massive hand, and tossed it over his shoulder.
Anyway, it ain't our killer.
Nope, that's not David Valentine.
Too bad, in a way. Old friend of mine, Ron Ayers, fought under him in Little Rock. Well, I'd buy this Major Valentine a drink if I could.
So you've told me. About 100 times. Okay, get your sick man out of here before we all catch it. I'd turn south for Clarendon about 3 miles along. There's an old grounded bus shell with Rural Network Pickup J painted on it alongside the road. No roadblocks that way to slow up your sick man, and I think this thing can make it through the wash at Yellow Creek.
Thank you, Sergeant.
Well, thank you for having such a pretty smile. Pleasant journey.
The Lower Mississippi, July. The river has reverted to feral since the cataclysm of 2022, a continent-crossing monster unleashed. The days of tugs churning up or down river with a quarter mile of linked barges are gone, along with many of the navigational aids. Barge traffic now looks more like a truck convoy, with various sizes of small craft and tugs pushing a few barges along the river in a long, thin column, led and flanked by small powerboats checking the navigability of the ever-changing river. There is one long stretch flanked by a northwest bend on one end and a southward hook downriver that causes the barge captains to press close to the unfriendly western side. This is the Tunica Sands, a stretch of river between Tunica and Memphis avoided by all the river rats as though it was cursed ground. 10 great weed-choked casino barges on the eastern bank are now landlocked thanks to silt deposits all around their keels. Like a latter-day leper colony, the entire area is surrounded by fencing and watchposts. Only the sick, under Reaper escort, go in. Only the Reapers come out again. The big cat hadn't changed much in the 8 years since Valentine had last seen him. A little less hair, perhaps. A little more waistline, certainly. But he was still the big, half-aquatic athlete of the Yazoo Swamps with a satchel full of apples. Ever-Ready had taught Valentine how to lower life sign and move without being noticed over the course of one impossibly hot summer, and the fact that he'd survived to return proved the effectiveness of his tutor's methods. The New Orleans Saints baseball cap was gone, though. Now he wore a black broad-brimmed hat that made him look like a missionary. Strung Reaper teeth rattled at his neck, and layers of bullet-stopping Reaper robe hung off his body in an oversized tunic that no sane man dared call dress. Finding him had been surprisingly easy. While casting about for a way to get across the Mississippi, they came upon a summer-out wolf patrol in charge of monitoring river traffic. The wolf patrol relied on Ever-Ready for information about the opposite bank in the Yazoo Delta between Vicksburg and Memphis, and the trio crossed the river in a birch-bark canoe with a guide who rested and camped with them at the rendezvous until the legendary cat appeared to trade supplies for data. Ever-Ready had no young wolves to train this year, further evidence of the still-echoing disruption of Solon's occupation and the continuing absence of the Lifeweavers.
Good to have you back, David. Even an old swamp hound gets lonely now and then.
So he was willing, after concluding his exchange with their wolf guide, to take Valentine and company into Memphis. They looked like four spirits in their first camp on the trip north around their Yazoo Swamp campfire, the humans under individual shrouds of mosquito netting, while Anka followed the grog manner by pasting his sensitive face and ears under a layer of mud. Valentine thought Duvalier looked like a silent film starlet, with face glowing in the firelight behind the layer of netting.
Only 4 ways into that town, barring being brought in handcuffs and bike guards. There's the river. They check everybody at the river, and they're damn good at spotting fake documents. And most visitors are kept to the riverfront anyway. Then there's the wall. There are gaps at the rock wall, of course, but the smugglers have gone to a lot of trouble to open them and watch them, and they won't let you through for free. Then there are the road gates, but it's the same problem, another document check. Most people who come to trade do it at Little City around Memphis. Then the middlemen the Memphis authorities know and trust go through the gates with their goods.
That's 3 ways in.
Yes, sir, Mr. Grog, that's only 3 ways. The fourth is a bit tricky. It's up along the Tunica Run. Tunica's a dumping ground for those that got the rabies bug. Memphis buys them cheap off their fellow Currians and dumps them in Tunica, so there's always a feed on for their reapers. Every now and then they release a batch on the west side of the river to give the free territory folks a little trouble, too. If you're careful, really careful, you can move north through the rabies colony. It's really just a big wall there and one gate. They watch the gate and patrol the wall, but not too heavily. Rabies types aren't into engineering ways over or under the wall. Too busy chasing their own tails.
So what's in Memphis that's worth all that security?
The banks.
Banks? There aren't banks anymore.
Yes, there are. Only kind of banks that matter to the Currians. Big marshalling yards for the transshipment of humans.
Tell her why.
Logistics. Memphis is only a day's rail from every big city on the eastern seaboard, plus parts of the Midwest and Texas. The parts your boys haven't took yet, that is. That's why old FedEx was headquartered there, too. Some courier in Kansas buys tractors from Michigan. He sends authorization to the bank in Memphis to ship up 300 folk or whatever the price was. They're on the next train to Detroit. Those yards are a sight to see. Let me ask you the same question. What's so important in Memphis that you're willing to risk going in?
We're looking for someone.
Unless he's got a job in one of the camps.
She.
Unless she got a job in one of the camps. Wait, is she a looker?
She's attractive enough, but there's more to it.
What do you mean?
Valentine tried to explain the mule list to Everready as concisely as possible.
There's this big old boy named Moyo who runs all the girls inside the wall. Always has his men checking inbound shipments for beauty. He's got a regular harem. Half the large-scale pimps south of the Ohio buy from him. He employs bounty hunters to comb the hills east of here to bring in folks to swap out when one of his men spots a pretty girl. Couriers don't really care. What's the difference between $1 coin and another? Moyo does a lot of high-priority transshipping. He'd be the first place I'd look for women on this mule list of yours, if it really is all women.
After that, he and Valentine spent a few minutes looking at maps. Everready chuckled that he hardly used the maps anymore. He knew the ground between Memphis and Vicksburg so well, and planning the hike north.
We should jog east a bit at the Coldwater. I got a store of captured gear you three can draw from.
How's Trudy?
Valentine jerked a netting-shrouded chin at Everready's ancient carbine. The well-oiled stock glowed in the firelight.
Still saving my life.
And the Reaper Teeth collection?
71 and counting.
All from fair fights, right?
Valentine, how you think I got this old? Only time I ever get into a scrap with the Reapers when they're so disadvantaged, it's hardly a fight at all.
Valentine woke to the smell of chicory coffee. Everready and Duvalier were the only ones up. Anka lay in a heap, wrapped around his gun like a snake that had swallowed a bullock before retiring to a too small tree. He listened to the conversation as he shifted around, feeling for creepy crawlies. He missed his old hammock.
I didn't know cats got as old as you. I thought we were all done by 30.
For a start, I stay in territory I know better than they do. I don't make a lot of trouble. I'd rather let my eyes and ears do the work.
Don't the Life Weavers ever have you?
I think they've forgotten about old Everready. But that's fine with me. Like to fight with my own set of priorities. I suppose that's how I ended up in this swamp.
Seems lonely. Do you go into Memphis often?
No, they know my face there. Not that I wouldn't mind visiting the pros down at the pyramid. Your pretty face makes me feel 20 years younger.
Wish I could help, but...
You're lucky. He's a good man. But be careful working with someone you got that kind of feeling for. The moment will come. Maybe you'll just have a split second to move, and you'll move wrong because of your feelings. You'll both wind up dead. Don't look like that. Just one old hound's opinion. If I knew what I was talking about, I'd have some hardware on my collar and be giving orders, right?
Let's see about breakfast.
I'll check the crawfish traps. Better use the big pot. That grog can eat.
Valentine waited to open his eyes until he felt the tip of Duvalier's boot.
You can wake up Anka. When he stretches in the morning, his gas drops the birds.
Everready's cache showed his usual craftiness. He kept medical supplies, preserved food, and weapons in several spots between the Yazoo and the Mississippi. The problem was keeping the gear away from scavengers. Humans could use tools, and animals could smell food through almost any obstacle. In the Coldwater Creek cache, he had solved the problem by burying his supplies behind a house and then placing a wheelless, stripped pickup body over it. Anka stood watch in a high pine while they excavated the cache.
The engine block's still in this, so she's a heavy SOB.
Everready retrieved a wire-cord rope from the house's chimney. The rope he fixed to the trailer hitch. Then he tied his Reaper rope top around the base of a tree, looped the rope around it, and fixed it. He handed the line to Duvalier.
Here you go, young lady.
She hardly had to lean as she applied a transverse pull to the center of the rope. The truck pivoted a few feet, exposing some of the dirt and a few hardy creepers beneath the pickup bed. Everready tightened it again, and she slid the pickup body another meter toward the tree.
Why the material around the tree?
Everready checked under the dashboard on the passenger side, and then pulled out a folding shovel with a gloved hand.
So the bark doesn't strip. You'd be surprised how clever some scavengers are.
The heavy-duty garbage cans within had further items wrapped up inside them. A few guns, thick with protective grease, boxes of ammunition, a large box of red pepper, ideal for throwing off tracking dogs, and a pair of shin-top-high camouflage-patterned boots.
You and I have about the same size foot, I think.
Valentine grabbed up the snake-proof boots like a miner spotting a golden nugget.
There's some good socks rolled up in that coffee tin. An extra pair should make up the difference.
Valentine smiled when he looked in the tin. It also contained a half dozen old Lifetime batteries with a logo of a lightning bolt-like cat jumping through a red circle. Everready liked to leave the 12-volt calling cards in the mouths of his kills. He brought up a cardboard box full of a dozen familiar blue tins.
Spam?
No, this was part of a larger shipment going to the Resistance farther east. I took a small expediter fee for getting the pony train there. There's plastic explosive inside the cans. You just got to pop the lid. There's even a layer of pork at the top.
Everready passed up another bag.
Three kinds of detonators. One looks like a wind-up alarm clock. One's in this watch, but you have to hook it to the batteries in the flashlight. And the others are straight fuses made to look like shoelaces, while the detonators are made to look like 9-volt batteries. Your armorers are clever.
Everready unrolled a chamois and handed a 9mm Beretta up to Duvalier.
This is a nice little gun, young lady.
Duvalier pointed at a cluster of long guns.
I'll take that Mossberg 12-gauge. Folding stock. Dreamy.
Don't you think you'll stand out a bit in Memphis?
Not after I rope it inside my coat.
Your duster's gonna look strange in this heat.
Not if I'm mostly naked under it.
Hope you're not looking for trouble in Memphis. Hard to get into, it's harder to get out of. Valentine, since you're going to be posing as a real, looking to add a few new faces to his line, you'll want something with a little flash. I took this off a wandering guitar man in a swap meet card game.
Everready picked up a sizable clear plastic food storage container and broke the seal. A long, silver-barreled automatic pistol rested inside with a shoulder holster and spare magazines. The gun was nickel-plated and would reflect light from miles away. No wonder Everready stuck it in a hole.
You don't mind 22, do you?
For this kind of job, I'd prefer it. It's quiet.
Only took you 4 years and some to add that word to your vocabulary.
And what else?
It's light, so you can carry a lot. And it's a nice varmint round for when you get hungry.
Exacto. Now, let's get you a long arm. Where did I put that son of a bitch?
Everready rooted through the guns and found a zipped-up case.
Ha, here we are.
He extracted a gleaming bullpup battle rifle.
This here is real U.S. Army issue. Took this off some half-assed commandos out of Jackson 8 years back. Called a Texas U-gun. U for universal. There's 4 interchangeable barrels and actions so she can shoot 9mm, 5.56, 7.62 with a sniper barrel, or you can open her up and feed her shotgun shells. Used to have a silencer, but I rigged it to a rifle I lost. Sorry. Nice little 4-power scope on top. Wish I could give you the grenade launcher for it.
Valentine checked the customizable sling.
This is great, but you keep Trudy?
A man doesn't give up on the girl he loves for a hotter model, even if she's sporting polycarbon rifling. Good gear means flash in the KZ. Don't have the full manual, but there's a card in the case that you should be able to figure it out.
Speaking of flashing, he could use a change of clothing.
Clothes will be a little hotter, but I think I've got an old officer's trench coat in here. Very nice waterproofing and only one small stain-free hole.
They rested atop a stripped Kenworth parked outside Tunica, within heavy-duty fencing and mounds of rubble blocking the roads south of the city, out of the line of sight of the nearest sentry tower, spaced miles apart on this, the less critical south side of Tunica.
You ready for this, Valentine? All your shots up to date?
So, we just have to move slowly?
Not so much slow as smooth. No sudden moves. I'm not saying a cough will set them off. Just that it could.
Anka, you'll be okay here for a few days?
There is food and water. I will stay in the cab of this fine vehicle at night and under those trees in the day. Are they less active at night?
Depends. If a few start prowling around, sometimes others join them. Then you get a mob mentality. They go off easier in groups.
Duvalier climbed up and hung off one of the rearview mirror posts and looked north into town. The mirrors themselves were gone.
I see one. By the traffic light that's touching the road.
Valentine saw it too. A distant figure staggered back and forth across the street, leaning forward as though trying to tie his shoes as he walked.
Poor souls.
Lots more, closer to the old casinos. That's where the missions organize themselves. That one's probably lost and hungry. Okay, kiddies, Got your iodine?
Valentine and Duvalier touched their breast pockets and nodded. Valentine had a big bottle, half full, courtesy of Everready's stockpile, and Duvalier had a stoppered hip flask holding the other half.
You get bit. First thing you do is get clear and iodine it good. Even if you had your shot, the damn thing mutates sometimes, and who knows what strain is in there. Plus, it'll save you an infection. Lots of these have hepatitis along with their other problems.
They started down the old road.
Don't shoot unless it's life or death. It'll just get them screaming, and between the shots and the screams, you'll have a herding of psychos on you before you know it.
Everready set an even pace, the old cat rocking a little back and forth like a ship rolling on the ocean. Valentine walked behind, U-gun across his chest in its hands-free sling. Behind him, he heard the steady footsteps of Duvalier, pacing her feet to Everready's rhythm. Valentine had had only one brief brush with rabies sufferers on the Louisiana border. Southern Command generally shot those who succumbed to the disease once their minds went and they didn't understand what was happening anymore. He'd never seen the after effects before. Seen? Smelled, more like. Tunica had once been a pretty town, Valentine suspected, fragrant of the magnolias and dogwoods beloved by the residents. Now, it smelled like a pig farm. Everready paused at the edge of what had been a park running through the center of town. The three of them stood opposite an old bronze statue of three weary-looking soldiers, the two on the ends supporting a wounded comrade in the center. Everready used the rifle of the one on the left to climb atop the bronze shoulders.
The kudzu's been cut back from here.
The growth choked most of the rest of the park.
Probably the mission people.
Everready covered his eyes as he looked around. Valentine heard cats spitting at each other somewhere in the park.
See those basins? Food and water. And there they are, over by the pharmacy.
Valentine saw two heads bobbing among the growth. Both men, with stringy-looking beards. They moved like sleepwalkers, the second following the first.
Careful now. If anyone hears an engine, let me know. My ears aren't what they used to be. Memphis dumps off fresh cases in the center of town sometimes.
They crossed over to one of the main streets. Valentine saw that what he had thought were only two individuals were six, hollow-eyed, tight-cheeked, and knob-kneed. Some shorter women and even a child followed the first two. Everready walked slowly and smoothly, like a man treading across a pool. Piles of feces lay scattered in the streets and alleys, drying in the summer sun. Valentine saw rats in the alleys, sniffing at the odious piles. Cats filled every shady windowsill and step, watching the rats. A pair of kittens watched them from beneath a wheeled dumpster. Valentine put his finger on the U-gun's trigger guard as the slow-moving train of people, or what had once been people, approached. The two files passed each other, the rabies victims' faces spasming in a parody of vocalization, black-toothed mouths opening and shutting, but no sound in their throats but dry wheezes. They looked sunburned and leathery. A few wore stained gray cotton smocks with URM stenciled on the chests and backs. The little girl seemed a bit more animated than the rest. She pointed and waved. Everready ignored her as the group passed by.
Erm.
United Relief Missions. Old school Christians. Down at the riverfront, Memphis lets them operate sort of as independents because they keep these folks alive, or what passes for it.
Looks like they feed themselves, too.
Duvalier pointed at the corpse of a cat with her walking stick. The cat's midsection had been torn out.
Wish it would rain. The town's a little better after good rain.
They crossed a street, and Valentine saw a heap of bodies, mostly nude, on the steps of what looked like a Neo-Georgian city hall. One kicked, and another rolled over.
Like hogs in a wallow. Cement gets cool at night.
They passed through streets of homes, perhaps one house in three burned to the ground, and the others crawling with cats and inhabited by crows. Valentine saw a larger flock gather and disperse around the crotch of a tree, and found the scavengers feeding on a corpse hanging in a backyard tree like a body draped over a saddle.
That's reaper work. Last night, by the look of it.
Uh-huh. Pickings are slim in Memphis. They come down here to feed. Memphis buys rabies cases cheap from all across the country and dumps them here. Sort of a walking aura reserve. I'm told they stay alive for years, till an infection gets them.
I didn't know they still used it except to cause us trouble.
I've heard of them dosing each other's populations when they feud, or to put down revolts. See, Nobody in the KZ gets inoculations except for Quislings.
How much farther? The smell is getting to me. I'm getting sick. Seriously, Val.
Everready pulled a little tin from his belt and set it on a stone and bar wall in front of one of the houses. He dabbed something from a green bottle on his finger and wiped it under her nose.
Just careful, breathe through your mouth.
Another pair of rail-thin shamblers wandered near the corpse in the tree. Valentine could have counted their ribs.
I don't like how that one is looking around.
Smells blood. Blood smell sets them off. Best not to move, just stand here. Like those statues at the memorial.
Not taking his eyes from them, Everready mechanically repocketed his first aid tin. Two crows held a tug of war over a piece of viscera.
Oh, God!
Valentine clutched Duvalier's hand and pulled her to her feet. Her walking stick fell to the ground, and Everready grabbed it, unslinging Trudy and running with the carbine in one hand and the stick in the other.
Follow me! Don't shoot, you'll just draw more!
Duvalier came off her feet again, wet-mouthed, unable to control her stomach. Valentine released his weapon and picked her up in a fireman's carry. He followed Everready up a short slope to an intersection.
Let me down! I'm okay!
Valentine went to one knee. He looked back and saw a dozen or so figures running in a more or less arrow-shaped formation. At this distance, their bare feet were so dirty that most looked as though they were wearing black shoes and socks. Kudzu-covered, tree-filled service stations and fast food restaurants lined the road leading toward the casinos, according to an ancient brown sign. Everready almost leaped across the highway toward a small donut shop. A shriek from the direction of the Mississippi let them know that trouble would soon be running in from a second direction.
Why not the bank?
A little way up the road, a stout-looking brick structure promised safety for money or those fleeing psychotics from behind a wall of scrub pine.
Too big! Can't stop them from getting in!
Valentine heard footsteps just behind. So sick, but able to run so fast. He dropped behind Duvalier and turned, holding the U-gun by barrel and grip. A swift-running young screamer got the butt in his face as he reached for Valentine. He went down, rolling. Valentine shifted his grip and employed the gun in a credible backhand. The screamer didn't get up again. There was no glass in the door or the windows. Everready vaulted over the counter and entered the cooking line. The display cabinet held nothing but empty trays and an oversized wasp nest. Valentine ran around a permanently parked car and entered the formerly white donut shop. Duvalier had tears in her eyes as she covered the front of the store with her pump action.
Here! Help me with this!
They fled into the cooking line, and Everready and Valentine moved a fryer to block the path to the narrow kitchen. The lighting seemed wrong. Valentine looked up and saw a hole in the roof. Weather or animal activity had enlarged it to the size of a picture window. Everready emptied the damp mess resting within a plastic garbage can and wedged it above the fryer. As Valentine heard screams from within the donut shop, he pointed to the hole in the roof.
Nice scouting.
Hope they don't climb up there.
Duvalier shifted her shotgun muzzle from the barricade to the roof hole. Everready put his back to the fryer.
Planning nothing. Never been in here to scavenge. I'd be shocked if there wasn't a hole in the roof for most of these places. Valentine, help me hold this. No, the plastic can, they're trying to crawl over. Girl, check the back, there might be a door.
Duvalier hurried to the other end of the kitchen and disappeared around a corner.
Oh, shit.
Duvalier flew back into the kitchen, her coat billowing and bringing the smell of cordite as she turned and braced herself against a tall refrigerator.
There's a door, or there isn't. That's the problem.
How many?
How many are there?
Thousands.
Sounds about right.
They came, more like a single organism comprised of screaming heads and waving arms than a series of individuals, filling the kitchen with noise. Valentine brought his U-gun to bear, feeling the pounding on the other side of the fryer against his back.
The roof! Go, Allie!
I can jump better than either of you. I'll cover you.
More appeared, and Valentine didn't wait to argue. He stood on a prep table and tossed his weapon up through the hole, hoping he didn't overthrow and landed in the parking lot. He grabbed an electrical conduit pipe and pulled himself up, got his foot into a light fixture, and climbed. The roof was thick with growth, and disturbed butterflies hurried into the sky. Everready passed up his gun to Valentine, and Valentine heard Duvalier's Mossberg.
Forget the packs!
Everready made it to the roof with less difficulty than Valentine. Duvalier crouched to spring up through the hole in a single leap, and they were on her. She spun like a dynamo, slamming one against the friar, even now moving from the pressure at the other side. Another sank its teeth into her shoulder, and yet another grabbed her.
Goddamn!
Though mad, though they felt no pain, her attackers weren't reapers. She pushed one off, kicked another, punched a third, pale limbs and coat a whirling blur of motion. Ever-ready shot a fourth with his carbine. Valentine dropped back through the hole.
No!
Valentine picked up her sword cane and used it as a club, swinging at the heads and arms coming around the friar.
Jump!
Ever-ready shot another one down. Valentine struck a ravi on the floor as it clawed at Duvalier's ankle. His kick broke its jaw. Duvalier crouched and jumped and went up through the hole like a missile. Valentine drew the blade from Duvalier's sword stick. Using the wooden tube in his other hand, he battered his way back toward the office. He felt hands clutch at his canvas boots and broke the grip. If they were snake-proof, they'd probably be rabies-resistant.
Val, where are you going?
Let me in that bike, girl.
Diversion!
Valentine rushed into the office. The back wall had bloody spatters and buckshot holes. A staggered Ravy, holding himself up on the desk, received Valentine's boot to his chest, throwing him back onto one coming through the door. Valentine pinned the fresher one like a bug on a piece of styrofoam with the sword point and vaulted through the door, running. Valentine ran through the parking lot, banging a dumpster with the wooden half of Duvalier's sword cane.
Ollie, oxen free! Come out wherever you are! London Bridge is falling down!
He hurried around into the next parking lot, banging on empty car hoods. Ravy's turned and began to run toward him.
Meet me by the casinos tonight!
Valentine could see the pair on the roof. He saw Ever-Ready applying a dressing and the iodine bottle to Duvalier's shoulder.
Come out, wherever you are! Hey, diddle, the freak and the fiddle!
The donut shop began to empty, and other ravies hurried up from the direction of the riverfront.
Ring around the rosy!
The last few around the donut shop turned toward him.
Warriors, come out to play!
Valentine didn't know what childhood game the last one signified, but an old wolf in Foxtrot Company used to employ the taunt on hidden grogs, clinking a pair of whiskey bottles together. He ran, and the ravies followed. Ten minutes later, and a mile away, Valentine's bad leg ached, but he had to ignore it. Ignore everything but the staggered line of ravies running behind him. His third right through the suburban streets in a row. The pursuers were screaming less, growing weaker, which was just as well. Valentine didn't know how long he could hold out. Two more blocks. One more. He summoned the energy for one final sprint to the last turn, running with the sword cane like a baton in a relay race. His speed came at the cost of a deep, deep burn in his legs and lungs. And there they were, a few stumbling ravies in a line, following the ones ahead of them. The very end of the long file of pursuers formed into a wagon train-like circle around six square blocks of Tunica suburbs. Valentine marked the crash scene he'd seen the first time he ran down this street, impossibly compact cars piled into each other in a rear-end collision, looking like the skeletons of two mating turtles. He staggered behind the cars and sank to his knees, desperately trying to control his panting. He peered between the cars, looking for his pursuers. They followed his path onto the tree-limb-littered street, caught sight of their fellows, and ran to catch up to them. Valentine was too tired to smile. He crept through the underbrush of a lawn, counted 20 of the pack chasing their own tails. Already some were giving up, dropping to their knees and scratching at the accumulated leaves and pine needles in frustration. Then he noticed the bite. Or was it a cut? Must have happened in the donut shop. None of them had been close to him since. But something had made his elbow bleed. He applied his iodine and silently prayed. Under stress, some men's mouths spewed obscenity, others Sunday morning verse. In this case, the latter felt more appropriate as the sting of the iodine took hold. The cut had some angry red swelling around it by the time night fell, and Valentine walked slowly and gently down to the riverfront. Two of the defunct casinos had electric light. Several had gigantic red crosses painted on their barge-like hulls, the universal symbol of help to whoever asks. Fire-gutted hotels lined the riverfront road. Valentine could picture the brilliant lighting above and around the multi-story parking lots, the banners along the streets, the florid wealth of a gambling haven opening at the side of the Mississippi, beckoning like a Venus flytrap. He kept out of the masses of somnambulists wandering under the lights, scooping handfuls of meal out of great troughs lining the streets. Naturally, more food meant more piles of feces, and more rats eating the feces, and cats eating the rats. He found an empty trough and passed a wet finger through it. It smelled and felt like ground corn, hog feed-grade corn at that. Some rice and millet, too. Valentine would rather eat the ants disposing of the leftovers. It came from the second floor of one of the hotels. He saw Duvalier's face in a window. He floated into the shell of the fire-gutted building, a concrete skeleton. She met him at the staircase with a hug, and they looked at each other's iodine-smeared wounds.
Let's hope the vaccinations weren't just water.
Rumor had it that Ravi's vaccine commanded a fantastic price in the Kurian zone, and Southern Command had its share of the unscrupulous. They crept upstairs. Cats, of the feline variety, scattered in either direction at their approach. Duvalier and Everready had his pack and gun. Everready extended a piece of greasy waxed paper.
Chicken and a biscuit. From the missions.
What's next?
A password to my contact in the missions. He's going to get in touch with a training man in Memphis. One of my sets of eyes in the city. Cotswold. Vic Cotswold. He'll take you in. Not the nicest man in the world, but reliable. He thinks I'm working for the Kurians down south, keeping tabs on things in Memphis. He knows me by the handle Octopus. Can you remember that? Octopus.
Great. What's my cover?
I took care of that, Val. You're Stu Jacksonville, a new pimp on the Gulf Coast. We know the area from our time as husband and wife, so there'll only be a minimal amount of bullshitting.
You sure you want to play a whore?
Not whore. Bodyguard. Comrade in arms.
Gay caballero?
Lesbian, if you want to get technical.
Memphis. The dwindling number of old-time residents of this good-time city divide Memphis history into pre-quake and post-quake. The destruction, the starvation, the Kurian arrival, the appearance of Groggs, all are linguistically bound together and organized by that single cataclysmic event. When the New Madrid Fault went, most of the city went with it. One of the few substantial buildings to survive the quake was the St. Jude Children's Hospital, whose grave granite now houses many of the city's Kurian rulers behind concentric circles of barracks and fencing. The rubble left behind was pushed into piles. Eventually, those piles were redistributed about the city, forming a 14-mile great wall of junk in a blister based at the river that eventually had dirt piled on top of it to turn it into a true barrier. Now a precarious jeep trail circumnavigates the city atop the wall, except for three gaps to the north, east, and south. The south gap is a subcarbuncle of its own, a fenced-in stretch of land between Memphis and Tunica full of livestock pens and grain silos, barge docks and coal piles. A supplemental reserve of food and fuel for the city in case events of war or nature cut it off from the rest of the Kurian order. Inside the wall, around the heart of the city, are the great bank camps, a temporary concentration of identical wire-divided cantonments that stretched in some cases for miles. Once a tent city for those left homeless after the quake, the tents have given way to 50-foot barracks, now wooden-sided, with windows and cooking stoves. Rail lines, sidings, and spurs stretch into the camp like the arteries, veins, and capillaries feeding the liver. The residents go out of their way not to think about those in the camps. Memphis still has some of its pre-2022 culture along Beale Street and in the Commons, the stretch of city bordering the waterfront. The Commons are dominated by the ravaged and only partially glassed superstructure of the Pyramid. This mighty sports arena and convention center has canvas stretched over the missing panes to admit air without the heat of the sun, giving it the appearance of an impossibly huge sailing ship squatting at the edge of the Mississippi, the trees of Mud Island separating its inlet from the main river. The area around the pyramid rivals Chicago's famous zoo as a center of dubious entertainments, though it is a good deal more exclusive, limiting its clientele to the river rats, the men who work the barges and patrol craft of the great rivers of middle North America, and those brave enough to go slumming. The pyramid itself sees a higher order of customer with appetites just as base. as a den where flesh is exchanged for goods or services, temporarily or permanently, the pyramid has no rival on the continent. While the city has any number of competing factions, captains of war and industry, mouthpieces both civil and Kurian, the commons and the pyramid look to only one man for leadership. The great auctioneer Moyo has bought and sold more slaves in his 40 years than many of the tyrants of old. Always to an advantage. If anyone has gotten the better of him and lived to tell of it, even the old-timers of Memphis cannot say. Cotswold was a heavy-set man and puffed constantly like an idling steam engine. He took up a substantial portion of the back cabin of his limo, a yellow-painted old Hummer. They'd met at a roadside diner built out of a pair of old trailers fixed together and put up on concrete blocks. Duvalier looked a little wan and not at all herself. Valentine hoped it was just the pain of her wound and not the onset of rabies. He'd know if she started trembling. That was usually the first sign. It might have been better to leave her with Everready in his casino barge hideout, but she'd insisted on accompanying him into Memphis. Valentine was dressed all in black. His costume was, in fact, a cut-down version of a priest's habit. It was the only well-made matching clothing Everready could easily find at the missions. Valentine had dyed the snake boots to match on his own, and after cutting off the sleeves, added a red neckcloth and a plastic carnation, scavenged from a discarded kitchen on one of the old gambling barges. He wore the gleaming pistol openly in its leather shoulder holster. The U-gun was zipped back up with the rest of their dunnage.
You wanna do what?
Learn about this fellow's setup. Everyone's heard of Moyo. Why not do what he did, only somewhere else?
Of course everyone's heard of Moyo. Nobody moves deposits in or out of this town without him. The reason Moyo's still Moyo is he doesn't let anyone get close to him who hasn't come up through his organization. He doesn't just hire golfies up to get a chance at the inventory.
Valentine had already learned two pieces of Memphis slang. Deposits were the individuals in the bank camps waiting for transshipment to their probable doom. Inventory was attractive women, and a few men and kids, he imagined, meant for the fleshpots, private and public.
Octopus is a good guy. Pays well for the little scraps of information that pass my way. What are you offering?
Valentine reached under his shirt and pulled up a simple lanyard that hung around his neck. A shiny ring turned at the end of the line. Everready had taken it off a dead general.
Brass ring. Is it legit?
It's mine. You get me in to see Moyo, talk me up, and I'll give it to you. I'm sure you have contacts who can verify its authenticity. If it doesn't check out, you can blow the whistle on me.
A coast ring's no good here.
But it is good on the coast. Ever think of your retirement? There are worse places than a beach in Florida.
A ring? You better not be doing a bait and switch.
A real ring and a friend named Jacksonville. The higher-ups are putting me in charge of Port Recreation. Gotta keep the plebes happy.
When's the end of the rainbow, Jacksonville?
I'm rebuilding the hotel down there. Furnishings are on their way. I just want to see about some inventory.
I'm your man. Just be warned. Stay on the up and up with Moyo. He's a razor, he is.
As they drove through the city, Valentine got a feel for the people of Memphis. For the most part, they were drab, tired-looking, clad in denim or corduroys. Hats seemed to be the main differentiator between the classes of the city. The workers wore baseball-style hats, turbans, or various styles of tied kerchiefs. Those who gave the orders wore brimmed hats. A broad-brimmed variety called a planter seemed to be the most popular. Cotswold's Hummer wove through horse carts and mopeds on the way downtown. They took a turn riverward to avoid the jagged outline of the old children's hospital. It had sprouted tulip-shaped towers since the advent of the Kurian Order. A communications tower next to the hospital supported ball-like structures like spider egg sacs, planted irregularly along the sides, a strange fusion of steel and what looked like concrete. But concrete globes of that size couldn't be supported by the tower. Cotswold stared studiously out the opposite window, reading billboards for birth enhancement medications. Something called Wondera promised twins or triplets with every conception. Another read, "Our goal, tranquility and justice for all." Yet another said, "Why settle for vitamins? Get Vitamax, guaranteed satisfaction, his and hers." Once in the summit of the city, the ground rose at the edge of the river before falling away sharply into the Mississippi. Valentine saw men and women dressed with a little more flash. Some of the women even wore heels. Many of the men sported suits that would cause heads to turn and mouths to gape in the Ozarks, broad-shouldered, pinstriped suit coats with matching trousers and patent leather shoes in a variety of colors.
It's a party town.
The car turned north onto a well-paved road and shot down an avenue of impressive new homes, looking out over the breeze-etched river. The car slowed and turned onto a broader highway that went down the steep hill to the river. Valentine looked up at the riverfront homes. All had balconies. Some had two or more. In the distance, to the north, seemingly sitting out on the river, he saw the blue and white checkerboard of the Memphis Pyramid. They slowed below a brownstone monstrosity, pregnant with a glass-roofed patio thick with potted plants.
That's my house. Should say the top floor is mine. I rent out the bottom floor to a colonel and his family. Helps to have friends in the city guard.
I admire the neighborhood.
But I'm hardly ever there. I usually sleep at the office. Hard to make good when you don't have your own bank, but I couldn't manage it. The faces get to me.
Valentine marked Cotswold as one of the Kurian's own survivors who made himself as comfortable as possible without hindering the regime. Valentine wondered, if born in a different time and place, would he shuffle loads of rice and beans in and out of his warehouses, trade in a few luxuries on the side, look the other way to avoid the faces? Docks with tethered small craft filled the riverbank. Valentine saw the soldiers of the city guard everywhere, the russet-colored cotton uniforms and canvas-covered sun helmets going everywhere in pairs. Pairs searching boats, pairs driving in small vehicles Valentine had heard called golf carts, pairs walking along the raised wooden promenades. They got out of the way for the Hummer. They passed into an amusement park. Valentine marked a merry-go-round in operation and a Ferris wheel, giving a good view of the area. Many of the other rides were motionless.
South end of the riverfront is strictly family fun. You should see it on Jubilation Day or Peace Week. People camp down all over the hillside. Great time. Except for the year 43 shelling. Vicious bastards across the river.